Once again, the smartest man in the world, Proofcast, takes to the ether. This time, from self-quarantine in the Porpoise of Fruititude. We join hands and join hearts and try to find some solace in each other's company via the social distance that we are forced to employ due to health conditions, times being scandalous like they are. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
How are you tonight?
Pretty good, all things considered. I mean, we looked in on our neighbors today. We went to the supermarket, got some supplies. Hilariously, our local grocery store was out of flour, and I thought, really, bitches, you're not going to go home and make sourdough bread today.
Everyone's baking from scratch during the cholera plague. And as you know, during times of great crisis, people come together and are kind to one another. And of course, to disabuse you of that notion and to make sure that you know that Hollywood is the horrible festering pit of ego that you think it is. Yesterday, two guys were driving down the road, drove through a red light, almost killed a couple pedestrians, honked, and were in an SUV.
They were in a Jeep.
In a Jeep.
And they were wearing surgical masks.
Thank you. For
they
their own 30, safety.
30-something white dudes in surgical masks in a Jeep.
For their own safety. And then today, in the car park of the grocery store, we're walking to our car, pushing our basket, and a woman with handicap plates is trying to get out of the parking lot, and a dude swooped out, backed out fast, which is, I've been hit there before in that car park, and she laid a little honk on the horn, and he rolled down his window and flipped her off.
Yeah, that was special. That was really sweet. You know, you want to reach out to people in these trying times.
You want to make sure that you determine that your privilege isn't being impeded on at any point during a plague, I think is really the focus, my focus. There's so much people have done, and there's so many wonderful acts of kindness. And
and thank God we're in California, and our governor is sane and is trying to address the situation and try to help the homeless.
He has a plan. They're moving trailers and renting
buying
hotel rooms.
Hotels, yes. Yeah.
They're springing into action, but the governor of California will find it. For those of you who don't live in California, which would be 7/8 of you, 1/8 of us do live here. There's 40 million Californians.
40 million. I didn't realize that we were 40 million at this point.
We're big. 333 million Americans, 40 million of us are from here. And this is what we say to you, right on. We have a governor who probity, jurisprudence, a sense of stewardship, more than that, a humanity and a real sense of responsibility toward making the state better. He was talking about homeless people today. He was talking about the elderly, getting them food, that these are real situations that we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. There was no self-congratulating. There was no handshaking. There was no touching the
mic.
There
were facts.
Yeah. And there was none of that weird stuff that you always awesomely call, you know, the dear leader, you're so beautiful, you're what does he say in Dune? Your swords.
Also, the people he surrounds himself with are multi-ethnic, lots of women.
Yes. Representative of the state of California.
Exactly.
Being the tall, patty white guy that he is.
Opposite of what you see on the federal level.
Well, they've tried to stunt cast it a little bit with bringing in the Surgeon General who wears the uniform and all that, because they really love
You're
that.
You're talking about the
feds. I'm talking about Orange 45.
They're doing everything wrong. They're touching the mic, standing
touching
too close. How many people have tested positive who've gone to Mar-a-Lago?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's not reassuring in any way, and I just try to tune it out and look at stat news, epidemiologists online.
Would you care to suggest any epidemiologists online, since that's a rather specific topic?
Isn't it, though?
Well, I mean, but it cuts to the heart of the matter. What you're getting from the White House, 45, Pence, that whole group, and dare I even say it, I think Dr. Fauci's a genius, obviously, and I would like to respect his opinion. He seems to be doing a yeoman's job of cleaning up after they've spilled everything, because they really cannot tell the truth. There isn't a bunch of places to go. You're going to have to go on a city and state level.
Well, the fact is, they actually fired the global pandemic expert.
He doesn't take any responsibility for that. You may remember and then 2 days ago when he brilliantly and boldly said...
They disbanded the National Security Council's Global Health Unit.
Oh, pish-tosh, useless bureaucracy.
Because who needs that? And then there was the disgusting news item today that 45 tried to buy a vaccine from German scientists.
Mm-hmm.
On the condition that it could not be used anywhere other than the U.S.,
Hooray!
Which is so vile.
We're number one, Jennifer, and that just proves it again. People get upset about this. The liberal, libtard media...
can't remember the quote, but Jonas Salk said something like, you don't buy the sun, about his polio vaccination, right. That this is for... all of us.
For the world.
Right.
No, not in his mind, Jennifer. When you have that, he's got that mob, you know, zero-sum game, I got to win every transaction mentality. And then when he loses, he can't be held to responsibility. He said he didn't take any responsibility at all for breaking up the pandemic resources that we had in place that Obama put in brilliantly after he kind of actually awesomely handled the Ebola situation in the United States. It didn't get crazy here.
Right.
We weren't forced to do what we're going to do now, which is spend the next 8 weeks together, you and I, making podcasts.
One of the people to follow is the person he put in charge of the Ebola outbreak, which is Ronald Klain.
Nice.
And I've been following, Ronald Klain suggested to follow Helen Branswell, who's a writer about infectious diseases for Stat News.
What's your handle?
It's at Helen Branswell, B-R-A-N.
Is it Brand or Brands? I can't see it.
Branswell.
With an S?
B-R-A-N-S-W-E-L-L.
As in all's well.
Yeah.
That Branswell.
And, you know, she just has the facts of what's coming in and the numbers. And occasionally she will recommend other people to follow, depending on where you're at in the world.
Where's your head at?
Exactly.
Can I ask you a question? Is that Ronald Klain the one that we see all the time on
Yes.
MSNBC?
Yes.
Well, he's quite good, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. He was in Obama's administration as a voice of reason and to calm us in this panicky time. And his bio is General Counsel Biden 2020, ex-Ebola czar, Obama, Biden, Clinton, Gore.
Yeah, ex-Ebola czar. So he's got a pretty good handle on the things that they put in that were stripped. Let's not dwell on the federal government's response, because it's been, I think, disastrous. Well, we shall find out in the next few weeks.
You and I lived in San Francisco in the 80s when Reagan was president, and he did nothing to help the crisis at the time. And that was the epicenter was San Francisco. There was the AIDS epidemic, and no one got any help. No one got medicine. It was just the community had to come together, and they did, but it was in dire circumstances. I remember waiting on people. I worked with people that had it. The love was amazing, but the fact that our government let them down is just...
How many millions of people died? And as Fran Lebowitz said so aptly, the cream of the literary, artistic, music, drama, dance, fashion, the community that was wiped out in the AIDS epidemic.
Strangely, given the timing, I wanted to mention before all this happened that the AIDS quilt is going to be shown in San Francisco next month. And at this point, it's, you know, it's enormous. And I worked at a video store next door to where it started. And one of my relatives is represented on the quilt, as well as many friends.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful way for people who felt like they were left out of the general picture, mm-hmm. to remember their loved ones and to celebrate them.
Yes.
In a very creative way. And also the size of it is impactful.
Because it's so overwhelmingly enormous. The thing, like you're saying, it's knowing that the federal government's not going to help you at all. In this instance, I think they're doing an after-the-fact, cow's already out of the barn, kind of rear-guard maneuver here, which isn't going to be that successful. But at least they've been forced to acknowledge and come out of the weird Fox News bubble that it's a hoax and that it's a Democratic conspiracy and all that nonsense that just drives public health into the ground.
It's a small world, and how many people have relatives or friends on the other side of the globe and you can talk to someone in Italy and find out how they're feeling, yeah. and then Spain and what's going on, or France.
Well, I think how many times are we coming back from somewhere, and everybody we've been with that's where the place we were has also been somewhere. If you're in Paris or you're in London or you're in San Francisco,
I mean, you can check in and see how they're coping with what's going on, and you realize that we're not putting those things in place as soon as we should have, and you have to look out for yourself and take care of yourself and, hunker down. This is a time to celebrate books and music and thank God that people have access to the internet, most people, and that you can reach out to friends on the phone.
If you wish to hear me perform live, you can direct message me on Twitter and I'll see what I can do. I mean, you know, my life's blood and our family revolves around the whole performing live thing.
But think about the fact that we know people and we have close friends who are people with conditions that prevent them from leaving their home.
Yeah, no, lots of
them. Or their care facility. Yeah. And this is, you know, people need to be kind and considerate.
I'm going to flip off people with...
In your Jeep?
Yeah, I'm going to drive my Jeep with a mask on through the town playing the Batman theme. And I'm going to really just take my toll. Shooting and looting. No, you couldn't be more right. You got to check in on the people around you, I think is super important. You think, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed, what can I do? Don't freak out.
Maybe ask the homeless person in your neighborhood if they want a sandwich. You know, whatever you can do. I mean, just little things. What?
Nothing.
Yeah, it's just...
I was agreeing.
It's a chance to reach out to people and show some consideration.
And you can communicate the way we did when we grew up with people, as opposed to the way everyone does now. You could actually ring them on the phone and talk to them. When I was young, Jennifer doesn't remember this.
Really? We're playing that?
Yeah. We would get on the phone with our friends. Say you were in 7th or 8th grade, you were like 12 or 13. You would call your friend and talk for 5 hours on the phone or watch whole movies.
I did that with Rex and Jen in the 80s. We literally talked for...
Right, from teenhood on. Well, see, you and I talk on the phone for hours at a time, which I don't think anyone does anymore.
There was the amazing... composer, pianist Glenn Gould in Canada.
The famous
and
phone calls.
There is a wonderful film about him. And he was exactly famous for calling his friends in the dead of night and talking forever.
Sometimes take loads of pills and stay on the phone for 5 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
And people recorded some of them.
They would fall asleep. They would wake up. He was still chatting.
And awesomely, as I recall, John and Yoko, aside from documenting every moment of their life with video and film, they recorded a lot of their phone calls. And one of their favorite guys they always called in New York was Elliot Mintz, mm-hmm. who was a New York personality record type. And he has all the calls. And sometimes on those Beatles shows, they'll play their phone calls, which are these epically long tirades of John going, I don't know what Paul thought he was doing with Maxwell Silver Hammer. We were in there forever. And then he thought it was going to be a hit. And it was just awesome. And then him talking about the yippies calling him and They're telling him they were going to bomb the 72 Republican convention, and he went, don't call
me
anymore.
Lose this number.
He goes, as soon as they started threatening violence, he's like, you can't do this to me. I'm going to get thrown out of the country for, like, even talking to you.
Right. It makes you think about how much he went through having to sort through the insanity and being that famous and, my goodness.
Phone calls are fun. And
that makes me think
you can drink together on the phone. Yes. You can watch cartoons
TV.
Together. Yeah. There's a lot of things you can do.
Watch a movie.
You can also be on the internet together on the phone. It's a lot of fun.
It is. And sometimes it doesn't replace for friends that, are going through something. It doesn't. A text, an email, it doesn't replace just Mm-mm. getting on the phone and talking to them. I mean, the other day when I talked to Jim, it was so much fun. We were just laughing our asses off.
Jim is Jim Sweeney from the Comedy Star Players. He worked with them for 30 years. He was in the comedy team of Sweeney and Steen for all of our English chums. They'll remember them from British.
He's still being funnier television. Than everyone is what he's doing.
Yes, he has MS and is in a care facility in an awesomely named Nutfield Park. And, He is hysterically funny, and he's so brave that every day I get up and I'm ashamed at what a cringing cupcake eating worm I am.
Well, and also the riffing that he sets the bar pretty high.
Yeah, he does.
You better show up.
No, if you're gonna phone him. Yeah. But talking on the phone is, like you say, my two favorite ways to communicate are postcard and phone, I would say. And then after
that... Yes, you are the king of the postcard.
Yeah, texting. I send everybody postcards. Get on my list.
It makes me think of Mark Crowley, who just recently went off to the stars.
He's receiving the Antoinette Perry Award in the sky.
I love that man so much. He was 84, and no one was ready to lose him because he was when he and I were together in August, he was killing me. He was running me ragged. He was.
You have to go back and tell everyone who Mark Crowley is.
Mark Crowley was the playwright who wrote Boys in the Band, the record breaking, the groundbreaking play about gay men. He wrote it in the 60s. It came out before Stonewall.
And he was openly out, and the play was about gay men.
He was one of the bravest people I've ever known.
So Larry Kramer and Tony Kushner, who are famous gay playwrights, who wrote...
They looked up to Mark.
And they came after him.
And he didn't really believe that until... there was a revival off-Broadway of Boys in the Band, and the New York Times put out a tribute to Mart and the play, and Larry Kramer wrote a piece about how much he looked up to Mart, and it really moved him, because I don't think he took that in. I don't think he thought that, because Mart was not a sentimental person.
That's a pretty fair assessment of it. Jennifer and I, full disclosure, we knew him pretty well.
I loved him. I mean, he and I were really close, and the reason that I thought about it was, why I segued right there was because I have saved all of his phone messages. And the thing that was so beautiful and also so tough about him was if I sent him just a haphazard email, I would hear about that. I would get a critique about maybe my
poor choice of words.
Exactly. He would be like, this isn't like you. What are you doing?
No, he expected you to be articulate at all times.
Yes. And you had better bring, what you have to the table, because there's going to be questions asked.
Yeah, we're auditioning.
Oh, yeah. At every moment, he was like that. And he was so disciplined in his life. The thing I hated about some of the obituaries was they called him a drunk, whereas I would say a man who is successfully sober for decades. He was fierce and uncompromising, and he was always reading.
I wouldn't say he was easygoing yoga.
No, he was not.
But contentious?
Fastidious. Was always learning. He was always going to... He went to every single play. He knew all the movies that were going on. He was up on everything. And I mean, he and I would laugh going, being deep and then shallow, you know, like we would say,
of course,
he would say, oh my God, Rachel Maddow's got a Navy blazer.
Right. You What's happened like, to the world? Woo! Why isn't she wearing black tonight?
And, you know, comments on people's makeup and, you know, like bitchy stuff like that. But then also all the deep things that were going on. And he was a reminder to me always, people are ageist. He was 84 years old. He was.
Was he really?
Ever present and ever up to date on
pretty
everything.
Springy.
And he would go, he came to the shows in Brooklyn, to Greg's podcast.
Came to Caroline's comedy club in Times Square.
Right. I took him to Nightmare Before Christmas in
Brooklyn. That's right. He came to that too.
He was just, you know, on it. And I had the great good fortune to, he took me as his date to a dinner party here in August. Ryan Murphy had a dinner in his honor.
Let me just pick up some of the names you're dropping here, Jennifer. This is getting kind of crazy.
And I mean, it was just, it was so fabulous.
Did you see American Horror Story, Pose, Johnny Versace movie, Ryan Murphy?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And
but tell him why, that he would have the party for him.
Well, because Ryan Murphy was... and Joe Mantello were behind the Broadway production of Boys in the Band, which was a smash. So they decided, and it never happens. It won a Tony. Mart won a Tony last year. It never happens that the brilliant cast and director and producer make the movie that they should.
And with the original cast.
It did happen this time.
Yeah.
And Mart got to see that, and he came out
Friedkin used a good deal of the original cast, didn't he? He changed a couple guys out.
Right. I just mean in general.
Yeah.
You don't see the right thing happening with the movie. And they got Bill Pope, the cinematographer from The Matrix...
Never heard of it.
And so yeah, just a ragtag crew. But Matt Bomer, Zachary Kinno,
right?
Jim Parsons,
and here.
They did Here and There. Robin De Jesus, who was nominated for a Tony, also
bloody marvelous,
right? And you know, the cast is just awesome. Ryan and his associate producer, Ned Martell, and Joe Mantello, everybody, we had dinner, and Mart got to go on the set each day.
They hadn't wrapped, right? This is in the middle of the shoot.
Yeah.
I had to go to England or something.
Right. And I actually postponed.
Right.
Because
you
was like, this has got to happen. And,
yeah.
And Mart was just, he was so full of energy. And after that, actually, he went to the Amalfi Coast because a friend of his had passed away, a dear friend of his.
I think that dear friend is an important figure because.
Richard Polo. Helped produce the first.
Right. The original.
Boys in the Band. And he was the man behind Joe Allen's and Orso. And was married to Trisha Guild, Designers Guild. And
Joe Allen's, when we first went to England, was such a hot spot in the West End.
Showbiz.
The food was always awful.
Wow. Okay.
What would Mart have said?
Mart never had a cell phone, which drove me up the wall.
Oh, I know, right?
And the night he won the Tony, when he came home, I was phoning him, and he picked up the phone, and he went, "You're the first person to call." And I said, "Yeah, because you don't have a phone." And he just came in. And
right. He was picking up the giant phone in the hallway.
He had a table in the entryway full of the playbills of all of the plays that he went to. His memory was phenomenal.
That was unbelievable.
And, the beautiful thing is he connected so many people, and they treasured his advice. And so many of us are reaching out to each other now. And I wanted to tell a story that Mart had told me last year.
Yes, please.
Which was when...
Is this the West Side Story one?
Yes.
Oh, please.
Natalie Wood had hired Mart as her assistant. But mainly, I think she knew what he was capable of.
Yeah.
And she wanted to support him writing his play, which he did. And they were very, very close. And when she was making West Side Story, they were shooting some of the scenes in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1961, I guess, or 1960, he was at a Halloween party, and he was in the hills, and Hollywood Hills, and with a group of the dancers, and they decided that they were going to dress up as the Bells of St. Trinian. And I don't know what it says about me, but I remember Martin was telling me this on the phone, and he said, "You know what that is?" And I said, "I do." And he said, "I knew you would."
But now you have to stop and explain what the Bells of St. Trinian is, because it's not funny unless you explain
why a
group of gay dancers that were working on West Side Story wanted to dress up like a bunch of English schoolgirls from a 1930s movie.
It was a 1950s movie with Alistair Sims. And Alistair Sims plays both a man and a woman in the movie.
Yes, he does.
And the girls are horrible. They're like little monster.
He's the headmistress of an all-girls school, right?
Right, exactly. And so.
But he plays it like he's a combination of Alec Guinness and.
I think Alec Guinness aspired to be Alistair Sims.
And Peter Sellers. I think they both thought Alistair Sims.
Oh, he's rare passing funny. So they decided to dress up as the horrible girls from the Bells of St. Trinian, which meant that they went to the store and they bought mops knee socks and skirts.
And this is all the good-looking guys that were the dancers in West Side Story.
Yes, and they muddied their
faces.
Can
I ask you a question? I don't want to stop it. Were they sharks and jets? Was all of them, right?
He said it was the gay dancers.
Oh, so it wasn't divided by the gangs in the movies. It was divided by which dancers were heterosexual and which dancers were.
So
homosexual.
Yeah, and so they had muddied their faces and had like fake bruises
and
scars.
Really, they muddied their faces?
Yeah, because they were, you know, these brutes, these girls that were just absolute, you know, delinquents.
Yeah.
And they... I guess they were outside, and a neighbor, this is the Hollywood Hills in 1960, a neighbor called the cops.
Boo!
And when the cops came, one of the dancers panicked and ran. And
really?
So the cop clubbed him. And then
this sounds very LA.
And then the dancers, or that dancer, ran into a house, but Mart said that there was blood. And they followed him into this house. They arrested all of them.
Oh, no.
And Mart, as the voice of reason, the dancers were panicked because it was in the evening. It was Halloween night.
Yeah.
They thought, oh, my God, we're going to be fired. And Mart said, you're in the middle of the big number. No one's being fired. They can't find this many dancers in LA. It's not New York.
Also, we shot a bunch, so we're not replacing 17
And
of
then
you.
They got one phone call for I don't know how many of them there were. And Mart said, let me handle this.
Really? And clubhouse lawyered it.
No, I think that they all were on board with that. And he phoned Natalie. And Natalie, I think at 3...
I just spit up my drink.
At 3...
He phoned Natalie Wood from the L.A. County Jail.
At 3 in the morning.
With a bunch of gay guys.
At 3 in the morning. And
not just gay guys, but the awesome dancers of West.
I'm assuming that it was like... I imagine her like Martin Balsam in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Right.
Like, she's in bed. Yeah, and she's got the phone by the bedside.
I got you on speakerphone. Speak up.
And she called her lawyer, and her lawyer got them all out, and they got out at dawn, and they really had no time, but they had to go right to the set.
Awesome.
They had been in jail all night and had to go to the set and do the big number. And Jerome Robbins, Mark told me, Jerome Robbins would work those dancers until they had to be carted off.
Yeah.
And so those guys were so badassed, they went right back out there.
Amazing. So they shot that day.
So if you watch the movie, be...
Which big number is it?
Vigilant.
Though? Is this the gang number?
Yes.
Oh.
Wow. That's how top of their game these guys were. And Mart, you know, he told me just a couple of months ago that he, and maybe I should have been mindful of, if you have older friends and they're reminiscing about further and further back, that you should take note that maybe that they're not telling you something about their health. I just, you know, I was thinking, well, no, I'm just saying, like,
I remember when I was little. What?
No, I mean, he was... he usually didn't look back. He was Mr., you know, move. He mentioned running away from home at 17 from his crazy life in Vicksburg, Mississippi, with his criminal gambling father and his mom, who I think had gone through all the doctors who would prescribe her pills and now was
What was his line? I couldn't do O'Neill because he'd taken all my characters or whatever?
Yes.
Because Eugene O'Neill's mother is always a drug addict and the dad's always an alcoholic.
So he ran away from home and he crashed this Paramount lot. He jumped the fence, he told me.
How old is he, 19?
17.
I love it.
And he,
he was
security,
a skinny little thing.
The security, and a tiny, and the security guard noticed him. And so Mart, he was so fierce, he just walked up to the newsstand and bought a paper and pretended that he belonged there.
Did he not get a shine as well?
Yeah, he did. He got a shoe shine, bought a newspaper, and
pretended. Right, so he acted like he belonged there.
Yeah, and then he left, and then there was this sort of lapse in the story where he had hooked up with a, quote, Pachuco gang in Bunker Hill.
This is getting downtown, pretty hot, don't you think?
Right? Which is like, talk about West Side Story.
Yeah, this is getting way hotter than...
I mean, his life, his dad was he was a...
Gangster?
Numbers runner.
Oh.
What was he?
How enchanting.
And when Mart was a child, he was holding the bag of money for his dad. And I think it prepared him to, quote, improvise later.
Well, yeah. Oh, no question. His alacrity in situations. Also, like you said, he was probably one of the most fearless people I've ever met in my life.
Right? There was never a dull moment. He told me about being threatened by an uncle because he was gay. And it was Mississippi. Mart was born in the 30s. He was ever... Oh, you've got Lena Horne. Lena Horne was one of his favorites. And... his father lured him back from L.A. by promising to take him to see Lena Horne in Chicago.
You mean one of the times he ran away?
Yes.
Lena Horne was an enormous star.
He adored Lena Horne, and he told me that so many of movies that he wanted to see had Lena Horne... at the end or in concert clips so that it could be taken out in the South. And his parents would take him to the New Orleans cinema so that he could see her.
They would excise her part in Mississippi and Alabama. And so she never had dialogue with other people in a bunch of the musicals
she was in. To spare them the magnitude of African-American talent.
And it's Women's History Month, so let's hear a little Lena Horne. Movie star, author, activist, singer, sex symbol.
And daughter of a gangster.
I'll get into that. Her father ran the Crawford Grill in Pittsburgh, and she worked there. And he was a big numbers runner. And as most of the people who owned Negro League teams in those days were... organized crime was one of the few venues available to African Americans to make any money. And so several of them were, particularly Cumberland Posey and this other, in any case, all the ballplayers convened there. And she was noted to have worked at the Crawford Grill, which makes her an awesome part of
every
moment of history.
Well, and Mark wanted to write about that.
Yeah, he did. Let's talk about that little screen for just a second, and then I want to...
Well, he told us about that when he was in Brooklyn with us at the Bell House, and he just couldn't sell the story, even though it's fascinating, about how she grew up with that kind of criminal...
Lena Horne?
Yeah, and he could relate to that, of course. He also wrote a pilot for Bette Davis.
Oh, yes. And I remember him telling us about going over to her hotel suite and having to... talk to her and read it to her, was it not? And she was quite forthright. This was the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's so many
stories. When he was a teenager, he drove to the set of an Elia Kazan film. And that just shows you his moxie. He was determined to get out of there. He never went back to Mississippi.
He blacked his way onto the set and became a PA for Elia Kazan.
Well, no, not right then. Elia Kazan remembered him, and then a year later, or 2 years later, Mart said he was in Midtown looking in the window of an art gallery, and Elia Kazan came by, and they ran into each other, and Elia Kazan said, "What took you so long?"
Right.
And that is just marvelous. And it, just like so much in his life, is just, you know, he made things happen.
And then because of that, he met Natalie Wood. And because of that, Natalie Wood made him her personal assistant. And it was her encouragement and support that got him to do Boys in the Band. He'd said he wanted to write it to her. And she was the one who put it forward. And when you see pictures of them from the off-Broadway production that ran for an astonishingly long time, it was a wildly successful play.
I think one of the things that just stands
out... She's always there.
Right. One of the things that so stands out for me with Mart, I mean, I love him so much as a friend, but as for everyone, he's so brave. He was so brave. No one was going to stop him.
No.
And even though I think for a good time in the 70s and 80s, that play was considered... in a negative light by a lot of gay men for the kind of people say self-loathing. I think now people, I think he was just ahead of his time. He was just too honest.
It's an astonishingly scathing and honest play.
Very honest person. And Lawrence Luckenbill wrote that beautiful piece, which was for American Theater Magazine, and it's called Courage and Candor. And I think that sums him up. And also,
it is a lovely piece because he talks about how brave and erudite Mart was and their long and enduring friendship, and how he doesn't take any credit. Larry Luckenbill's heterosexual, and he took the part in Boys in the Band, and everyone told him not to, right? And the whole point of the first cast is that they all took a terrible chance playing a gay person in a play.
And isn't that shocking? I mean, they really, their agents considered it at the time to, it would be ruinous.
Isn't that the amazing, other, though, that they all had the wherewithal and that they were all so...
They believed in it. And, and
that's who he thanked, though, when he wanted the Tony. He didn't even, the new cast didn't get, he said the original cast, what... that was nine brave souls and all that. It was amazing.
Well, very much so. And Edward Albee also believed in the play, which is a really amazing fact. There's also a lovely remembrance in The Advocate by Christopher Herity. That, Ned Martell sent me that. It's just, I think he touched so many people and he helped so many people. He really tried to be constructive in his criticism. Sometimes harsh, but just what a dynamo, and it's so hard to lose him when he was, you know, I said to him just a couple months ago that he was running up and down the Amalfi Coast like a mountain goat.
Right.
And so I guess for someone like that, I can't imagine him being less than being able to terrorize the staff at his apartment building and run out to hail a cab and not letting anyone younger help at any point.
Now, Mark was not someone that wanted to be coddled or, I mean, he enjoyed it if you were considerate and showed up with a car or whatever. But yes, there was many nights when he would run into the street after we were with him and act like he was trying to get away.
He wouldn't let me take him to his door because it was always like a cost-cutting measure.
Right.
It was his idea. And it was like, I'd like to see you to your door because I can't sleep at night if I don't.
Right. Also, you're 80 and it's snowing. No, he was adventurous. I want to say one last thing, if you don't mind. We went and saw the Tony Award-winning version in New York, and we saw Mart afterward. But what I wanted to say was, on the night, there was so much, and this is going to sound so awful and contrived, I can't believe I'm going to say it,
wow,
gaiety in the theater.
Really? How gay was your gaiety?
Super gay. Not only were people celebrant about the revival. The revival was cast perfectly. It was realized beautifully on stage. Forgive me for not remembering the set decorator's name. The set designer, the set was sensational. Mm-hmm. It was red and velour.
It looked like Halston's apartment.
Oh, my God. There was a shower on stage, and there were black cashmere sweaters, and everybody was dressed so swank. And they all looked so beautiful, and everybody in the cast was an eminent actor in their field. There's no... It was cast to blazes.
Right.
And the realization of it, Joe Montello's... staging of it, the cutting and the editing of it, because they broke it down into two succinct acts. And it's a real punishing play about a birthday party where...
Well, I wouldn't say punishing. Mart hilariously complained to me that at the end of the production that people were acting like it was a party.
Yes.
And I thought, well, you know, God forbid, it really became like...
Well, what I was going to say was that the atmosphere before it started was so buoyant, and there were really cute drinks in the foyer, and they were like the boys in the band martini and this and that, and at the interval, everyone was buzzy, and after it was over, the curtain calls went on for ages, and everyone around us was losing their minds, and there was so many...
Yes.
Happy people and gay married couples. That
the stretch
between 1967 and even with everything going on, it was a really triumphant version.
David Zinn did the set.
Ah, thank you.
And
it was a triumphant version of the play, and it triumphed night after night. I think it could have run another 6 months, but they didn't, because all those actors are so booked and busy that they had shit to do. On the other hand, we're going to get a movie out of it, and it's the cast of the Broadway show.
Yes, it will be on Netflix. I think it premieres in June, and there's also a making of, and Mart will be in that, and it's really fantastic.
If you don't mind shifting gears, Mart, I know, was the dearest of friends to you. I have some upcoming gigs I'd like to talk about. Oh, wait.
Exactly. Can I mention this?
Oh, yes, please.
So 2 weeks ago, I went to see an investigative journalist, Jerry Mitchell, read from his book, Race Against Time, which it made me think of Mart, and I was thinking about discussing it with Mart before I found out that Mart was in the hospital. But because Jerry Mitchell is from Jackson, Mississippi, he wrote for the Clarion Ledger, he now has, where is his card? He's got a organization called the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. And if you want to donate money, they do important work. And what kind of important work? Well, the book is about, in Race Against Time, Mitchell takes readers into the pulse-pounding investigation that reopened four of the most infamous cold cases of the civil rights movement: the assassination of Medgar Evers, the fatal firebombing of Vernon Dahmer, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham that killed four girls, and the Mississippi burning murders. He devoted his career as an investigative reporter to these cases, and his work helped send four notorious Klansmen to prison.
Yes, he did get convictions.
It's really amazing what he got done, and he is good friends with Merle Evers, Medgar Evers' widow, who gave the invocation at Obama's second inauguration, and there was so much going on in the room at this reading. There was
talk about meeting him and everything.
There was a black man there from Laurel, Mississippi, who said that Jerry had helped his dad become the first black mayor of that town. Jerry Mitchell spent a lot of time with Klansmen, trying to get them to confess, and they were you know, I guess they don't have friends because their lives are full of hatred. And as he said,
do you think the narrowness of their bigotry was what proscribed the loneliness of their path? Yeah.
And what he said on the night was, he felt before the hatred was fear.
Just James Baldwin said.
Yes.
Because they'd have to face with the pain.
Yes. And that ultimately, some of these guys outed themselves because they just didn't have anybody to talk to.
And so they ended up talking to the reporter that was trying to turn them in.
And also, some of them didn't even know that he was that reporter.
You mean the lack of information and the bubble that they lived in?
Yes.
Which is so indicative of so many things.
Yes. And one guy actually
white supremacy is, that's
had
is,
his
though.
Business card and phoned him because he wanted to give a shout out to another one of the Klansmen. And, you know, they just gave themselves up, basically. He has been such a staunch friend of the Evers family, the Dahmer family, who he said when their house was firebombed, four of the sons were serving in the military.
Right. They were the most American of families, so patriotic.
Jerry Mitchell was with the Clarion Ledger in Jackson forever, and then the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. If you can, give them support, do. If you can follow him on Twitter, do, because it's always about American history, however ugly that might be. And he is a lovely, soft-spoken person. He's
so tiny, you said.
Disarming. Well, he's a very thin, soft-spoken gentleman, and
so eloquent online.
Yes, and he is dogged in his defense of what's right.
And, well, civil rights and being an unbelievable advocate for people in Mississippi. And as you always say, you know, we've been to Mississippi. My mother's side of my family is all from Mississippi. All my aunts and uncles.
Mart was from Mississippi.
Mart, our good friend John Epperson, who's also has an alter ego named
Lipsinka.
Lipsinka. As we've discussed, Dizzy Dean. Elvis Presley, the list goes on and on. Mississippi is astonishing. Eudora Welty, is it?
Well, as Jerry Mitchell says, some of the poorest people and some of the richest soil, the greatest number of illiterate people and the largest number of great writers.
William Faulkner.
Eudora Welty.
Yeah. John Grisham.
Yeah, I mean,
and the one they always get mad at when I say Taylor Caldwell. My mother loved Taylor Caldwell. No one even knows what I'm talking about now. We've drifted into irrelevance, and I love it about this show.
You know, Mart was from Vicksburg, and Vicksburg's also where Evers was from.
Medgar Evers was the head of the NAACP. Merle Evers was an activist.
No, but Medgar Evers was based in Jackson.
Yes,
but Vicksburg is also where Jefferson Davis was from, born.
Jeff Davis is an amazing figure in American history and one of the great racists.
I'd say villain.
Yeah. Oh, great racist. They let him live in New Orleans, right, at the end, after he was president of the Confederacy and whatnot?
Yeah.
Did they not move him to a weird house where they said when he died he would appear as a ghost in the window and all that? There's that weird mythology about him. Yeah, I would say one of the great villains in American history, like Robert E. Lee or, you know.
The Mississippi Delta is also the blues. And I don't understand people that say like, oh, well, you know, it happens there, when they don't recognize that, as I said to a friend here a couple days ago, you don't have to go far outside of our zip code to encounter racist elements.
Oh, it's not limited to the South, certainly.
No, but people want to stigmatize them, and then that means that
I've done it as much as anyone. I've made more Mississippi
jokes
than
vulnerable people
any.
Have to suffer, and that's not fair.
But they were always about white people and my relatives, so I always felt it was fair to do it.
I remember when you and I went to Jackson with Liz Winstead to support the Pink House, Mart was just aghast.
Yeah. He thought we were going to be stoned to death by the Christians of the town.
Right.
But, and it wasn't quite like that, as you recall.
Well, we were in Jackson. We didn't go outside of Jackson. Jackson, the city, is majority black. And
yes, outside's where the white people live.
Yeah, like dangerous people are outside of Jackson.
Yes. the Ross Barnett Reservoir being a real hot spot around the Jackson
area. There's some fabulous restaurants in Jackson.
I love Mississippi. Because my parents are gone, which makes it a lot easier for me to go there. And Mississippi's a lot of fun. And this was something that...
Well, don't write these people off. Help them. Help the people that want...
You mean in the 50th
Mike Espy
state.
Is running for Senate. Yeah. He is an African-American... And he's running for Senate from Mississippi, and he could use some support, and it would be great. He got very close last time, and hopefully...
He did in all. Mississippi's representation in the Senate and their governor is pretty shocking stuff. But demographics, I think, will out, and I really believe, because of the state of affairs, that... People are taking things seriously to heart about what they're voting for and whom they're voting for. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see, and I may be wrong in this, but I don't think I am. 2016 and 2018 were these overwhelming, if you'll pardon the expression, plebiscites, were these overwhelming votes on putting women in office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that continues. I don't think it abates at all. And I think that also... the hatred and distrust of what's going on is so violent and so real that I don't see people letting that go. And I think that the polls and the mainstream media, all this nonsense, you've seen how Biden came back against every narrative that was supposed to be laid against him and shit like that.
And didn't spend any money...
At all. He made a dime phone call from a booth in a bus station while he was buying a paperback.
Well, we all have to... pay attention to how African American women vote.
Thank you.
They are, if you want to besmirch people by calling them the Democratic establishment, if John Lewis is the establishment, if Elijah Cummings, if Jim Clyburn,
Maxine Waters.
Right. If Maxine Waters and Barbara Lee and
Val Demings.
Yeah.
Carrie Bass.
Then I'm 100% with them.
Me too, baby. Let's talk about some awesomeness. McCoy Tyner was everything.
Oh, my God.
He joined Coltrane's band when he was but a child. He's in a classic quartet. Jimmy Garrison and Elvin Jones, John Coltrane and him. I know it's cliche in the jazz world, but for all of y'all, I think we just need to hang for a second. McCoy Tyner. Did he get a chance to shine or what? It's so beautiful how great his career is. He played with everyone. And notably, this quartet with John Coltrane. But his solo music is so astonishing.
And John Coltrane said, McCoy Tyner holds down the harmonies, and that allows me to forget them. He's sort of the one who gives me wings and lets me take off from the ground from time to time.
Isn't this quartet like
Isn't
the Miles
cool?
Davis? Yeah, it falls in line with so many other great outfits. Dig.
I love the album with him and Alice Coltrane and Ron Carter.
The left hand. Wow.
From the Atlantic obituary, it says, Tyner wasn't just recycling old blues tricks. To hold those harmonies down, he reached for unusual modes, alternatives to the familiar Western scale, and left room for experimentation by using chords with the interval of a fourth. By sidestepping the third note of the scale, Tyner could make the music seem neither major nor minor. The openness lent itself to sweeping vistas of sound.
I think he's just There's no way to kind of describe his virtuoso-ness. He's this critic, John Fordham, wrote a sentence that I thought was fairly descriptive about, in my 50-odd years of listening to jazz, Tyner's 2002 concert at the Barbican, London, with Hutcherson bassist Charnette Moffett and the drummer Eric Harlan, stands out for its incredible mix of headlong momentum, ritualistic insistence, and elegant lyricism, along with the characteristically meditative ferocity of Tyner's solos. That year, he received one of jazz's highest accolades when he was named a jazz master by the National Endowment for the Arts. Wow.
Just gorgeous.
What you read, Jennifer, was so amazing about losing the third in the chord.
The album I was thinking about is called Extensions.
I've got it right here.
Oh,
hello. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Extensions is Tdep. And let me just spin a little. This is a way different bag, and Alice Coltrane's on it.
And Ron Carter.
And here we go. You're going to dig this. It's esoteric and it's great. There's Ron Carter.
Unmistakable, right?
By the way, this jam's called Message from the Nile. Alice Coltrane on a harp. He considered quitting jazz at one point and becoming a taxi driver, according to The Guardian. I don't know how true that is, but it's awesome. He did not like electric...
Philip Glass was a cab driver.
Yeah. He didn't like electric jazz. He liked organic jazz. Editorial note in the middle of this. This record is called Extensions, this album.
I love the cover.
And what... Yes, exactly what I was going to talk about. When it came out, and it's from 72, I believe. It says 73 here, but you know how that is. It's in the style of National Geographic, which famously patronized Native people all around the world for a good 100 years.
Yeah.
And it has the typeface of National Geographic and the color border, the golden border of all that. And in the style of a National Geographic magazine... it says Extensions, McCoy Tyner, and there's a group of black people wearing colorful textiles and sitting much like they would have on the cover of a National Geographic, and it's a brilliant
critique of that.
Yeah, it's astonishing. And the record is the jam, baby.
Yeah, it's just beautiful.
McCoy Tyner.
I know. Do yourself a favor and seek out.
There's nothing.
The many, many albums that he's on.
A 50-year career. He played with everybody. Joe Henderson. 8 million albums on his own. I mean,
it's hard. We haven't even gotten to Max von Sydow.
It's hard to get off McCoy Tyner. I don't want to get off McCoy Tyner. I could listen to this.
Right? It's so gorgeous. Can I tell the Max von Sydow story?
Yeah, I'm going to turn this down, and then I'm going to. Here we go.
We were at the TCM Film Festival a few years ago, and
1968. What a year! Oh my God, Peter Yates' Bullet. What a sensational year!
So they have a party at the beginning of the festival for the people that are presenting and the honored guests, and we went to the party, and Greg had gotten up to get me a drink. you know, surprise. And
this story's starting really well.
And I was sort of tucked in a corner, and I was looking around thinking, like, I don't know how much longer I want to be here because of where I was. And I was in front of a table where Tippi...
Are you complaining about being at a TCM party with Tippi Hedren and...
Well, let me even me describe the circumstances. I was in a corner, and there wasn't a lot of action seated. And I was in front of Tippi Hedren, who was with some friends.
First of all, you've already gone to Tippi Hedren in this story, and we have to explain who Tippi Hedren is.
She was the star of The Birds and Marnie, and she is also mother of Melanie Griffith, who I think is undersung. Anyway. I love Melanie Griffith.
And we were talking about that picture the other day. What's it called? Another Day in Paradise.
So, Last Day?
That's an amazing movie.
Anyway.
Strange.
I'm sitting there alone, pondering my circumstances.
Right.
And
at the TCM party with no drink in your hand.
Exactly.
Bereft of one, waiting for me to come back from the bar.
Right. Imagine the horror.
Right.
So, I look to my left, and one of my favorite actors, Max von Sydow, sitting on a couch.
Did you say Max von Sydow?
And he's just looking like he would rather be anywhere else. And now I'm thinking, oh no, I must stay because this is awesome. And then Lulu. Yes,
wait a minute,
whoa,
put the brakes on
Lulu. Is there,
you mean
because
Lulu from Two Sir with Love, Lulu?
Lulu is there because she's going
Scottish songstress Lulu.
She's going to be interviewed before To Sir With Love later in the week.
Nice.
She gets up on stage with one guy on keyboard and does the theme song To Sir With Love.
And I remember this part. If
and
you
it was a bit...
In. It wasn't the greatest version that I've ever...
It was a bit awkward. And I look to my left, and Max von Sydow is not having it.
What?
He is giving the best Seventh Seal, my face is carved in stone, and it might be from Easter Island look. And now I'm just, like, committed. Now I'm like, this is the best show. I've got front room seats to Max von Sydow hating Lulu. At that point, Greg Steele's not back. Mitzi Gaynor comes in a gold leather bomber jacket.
Mitzi Gaynor?
Escorted by two gay men.
Yes. Oh, they were showing South Pacific.
Exactly.
At the festival that year.
And Max von Sydow looks like he wants to kill everyone.
Yeah, he's grim, as I recall.
And his wife's not back with his drink.
Right, and she went to the bar to get
the
white
wine.
He's
there with his two sons and his French wife, and he's just awesomely full of anger.
And he was watching her sing To Sir With Love.
And I'm the whole time I'm watching him watching her. And it was just... Then later in that week, we got to see him being interviewed by Leonard Maltin.
Yeah.
And it was so... It was such a relief to find out that his politics were expansive and liberal. He lived in Paris. And he watched Seventh Seal with the audience, which
we watched.
Pretty fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think the next day we went to see him.
3 Days of the Condor.
Right, be interviewed for 3 Days of Condor, which is a family favorite. And he sat in the third row to watch the opening segment.
Yeah.
Which...
Move away from the window, please.
So great.
Please
He's such a... Oh, my God. His role as the hitman in that is...
The one who paints toy soldiers.
Right. He's just alone in his hotel room.
They did not know you'd be here.
I knew you'd be here. Would you like a ride?
You might join me.
One day a friend...
What is it? Flash a smile? A becoming smile. Someone you know, perhaps even a friend, will pull up in a car and he will flash a smile, perhaps a becoming smile.
Max von Sydow was one of those actors like...
Do not get in that car.
Christopher Lee, not only was he, I don't think, ever gained a pound...
6'4".
He was busy at home burnishing his face made of granite.
Yeah.
But also he couldn't stop booking in his 80s, yeah. like Christopher Lee, like for real. You're going to have an Oscar nomination in your 80s?
We saw him in person, and the three things that he said that I loved the most were, after I played Jesus, I was only offered, what was it, the popes and stuff like that? And then he went, casting directors have no imagination. Mm-hmm. And then he said, the deafer I get, the more I like silent movies. And that made me love...
He had a sense of humor.
He said he was watching silent
movies. I don't think, even though he made 11 movies with Bergman, I don't think there was a lot of love there.
He called him Mr. Bergman.
Pointedly.
Over and over. And he was in his 80s when he was doing that. Yeah. That was what was weird to me, Jennifer.
It was a distance, and it was you knew what it meant.
I so know what it meant, but it was
also the beginning.
Them.
Can we discuss at the beginning of Seventh Seal? He's like,
oh my God,
he's like
what
a found Viking object on the beach.
Yeah, no, no.
That has been burnished in the sun.
Right.
And you may not come any closer.
No, absolutely, yes. It's he's like finding a piece of a Viking dagger with a bejeweled Viking dagger laying there. You can tell his eyes are blue in the black and white film.
And remember on the day he said that he thought he did, that he was wooden in it. And you just think, well,
you're right,
it didn't.
Though.
No, but it didn't matter. He's an icon in it.
The reason why it works is he is that wooden.
But
he
the
seems
weird
like
thing,
a knight from the 13th century.
Well, but
or 14th century, whatever it is.
Fortuitously, he becomes a great actor.
Yes.
Fairly rapidly after that.
No, right. It's early. Maybe he is a little earnest, but it doesn't hurt the movie in any way. He seems like a chess piece almost. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Am I wrong in saying that?
No.
The actors in the movie.
He's supposed to be an archetype. He's a cipher of a person.
Do you hear who I'm playing here? I'm playing a Cabi Lauretel, all of Bergman's music.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Anyways, Max von Sydow, not only was he a wonderful and honest actor who played flinty, gruff, austere, almost otherworldly, like Steppenwolf. There's so many roles mm-hmm. that he played that were just Pele, all those pictures. Even in his comedies, like Hannah and His Sisters, where he's really funny. I'm sorry I brought that one up, but he's very funny. Because he plays an austere artist who's tossed over by his younger girlfriend. Strange Brew.
But by that point, he was so famous for his Bergman films that he was playing in American films himself.
He was so larger than life. Jennifer and I think, agree about several things.
Really?
Yeah. One of them is, of course, that McCoy Tyner's fantastic. Two, that the greatest movie stars are Myrtilla Mastroianni, Tishra Mafini.
And Max von Sydow.
Max von Sydow, Robert Mitchum, whatnot.
Alain Delon.
Right.
Jean Moreau.
Yeah, Jean Moreau. Right.
Faye Dunaway.
Yeah. Glenda Jackson.
Maggie Smith. Yeah. Glenda Jackson.
So I think that's why. He made a bunch of pictures. He's in 15 pictures with... he made a load of pictures with Bergman. Then, fantastically, two times ago in the show, we talked about The Greatest Story Ever Told. I'm sorry I'm bringing it back. By the way, he turned down Dr. No. Joseph Wiseman is Dr. No, and he's like, oh, Mr. Bond.
This is unsavory.
Later, Max von Sydow played Ming the Merciless in a terrible movie called Flash Gordon, and he's awesome. What I want to get at is...
Yeah, there were several interesting dips.
It's not that he was dabbled in nonsense. We all do. It's that he had the range to be an hilarious vaudeville comedian, and he was also the most serious actor you've ever seen. Max von Sydow really did have that. Like Tishra Mafini, like Marcello Mastroianni, had that capability of also good-looking, like... He's good looking in a disarming way because sometimes he's scary and
oftentimes,
sometimes he's a psycho.
We showed High and Low the other night, which is just a wonderful film. And I was noting that even though Tishra Mafini isn't in a great deal of the latter part of the film,
He disappears in Act 5. Sorry.
There's a scene where he's mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
And the chauffeur is distraught because Toshiro seems almost like he's making a zen, happy moment of mowing the lawn. And the others around him see it as a profound step down for him.
You have not explained the plot of High.
Well, I don't think you have to explain the plot to say that his character is at a moment where others think that he should be distraught, but strangely, he seems not that bothered. And I was just wanting to note that Toshiro Mifune could make mowing a lawn seem profound. Because he was that character. Like Max von Sydow can make lying on a beach look like an archaeology project.
I was going to say, the existential exploration of what the motivation of mankind is supposed to be up till this point. And Marcello Mastroianni could make serving drinks in a white waiter's coat on a boat in a spa or whatever seem like the most...
His daughter, in an interview, Chiara, said that her mom is Catherine Deneuve. Her father was Marcello Mastroianni.
She must
said,
be cute.
Well, right? And really, well, she said that she would go home to her dad and it was always a party. And you just think that is really his rep in life.
I back Marcello Mastroianni's corner harder than almost any.
There was a photo of him in the 60s. He's in a fur coat. Yeah. By the pool.
With a hat and sunglasses.
Which is full of people. And underneath it is, his quote is, I lead a simple life.
I lead a simple life. It's just me and...
off the Appian Way.
Yeah.
At my villa.
Right.
I'm having a party.
And what can only be described as a cavalry charge of women. Like a division of women. And not just women, but like the hippest.
I lead a simple life.
The hippest women of Europe have gathered to try their luck. It's just, wow. No Marcello. But I think Max von Sydow, and I wasn't trying to denigrate
him. He was thoughtful. He was, when we saw him being interviewed, he was really intelligent, really in the know, wanted to talk about politics probably more than that audience wanted to hear.
Oh, God.
And funny.
Really funny. Here's my two quotes that I wanted to surprise you with. When he was in Greatest Story Ever Told by George Stevens, he blamed George Stevens. Awesome interview from 88.
I blame George Stevens.
Yeah. He tried to make the ultimate version of the life of Christ in order to satisfy everybody, not stepping on anybody's toes. And I think that's the last thing you should do. It's just a theme.
Is that Swedish?
Unfortunately, the film turned out to be very beautiful, but very boring. And this is where Max von Sydow crests the wave and high fives you as he goes to Andromeda. Very boring. Beautiful, but very boring. And a lot of walking. Very serious walking.
Hilarious.
If you remember the picture, he walks a lot in it. It's just...
as you always point out, Sidney Poitier is there.
It's so good.
To help Jesus on his way.
He made pictures in America. This is the great one here. I'm skipping that one. This is the one I loved. He did Pele the Conqueror, which is a bloody marvelous... let's see here.
Right, it's a tour de force. He's the central figure.
Here it is, yeah. What I wanted to read was, this is how he fucked with people, and I love him for this. He played a widowed Swedish farmhand who moves to Denmark. All right, I already checked out. Here we go. This is the best part. It was it got the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. And Roger Ebert said, quote, about Max von Sydow, unsurpassed at the difficult challenge of appearing not to act.
Hmm?
This is the part that was so goddamn funny, Jennifer. The film's producer, Per Holst, told the New York Times he was worried he couldn't afford Max von Sydow. He called the actor's agent and said he was on as long as the usual arrangements were in place. Airplanes at his disposal between takes.
Between takes?
Chauffeur-driven limos and champagne at breakfast. And I thought, oh God, how do I pay for this? Before I heard laughing at the other end of the phone. He was joking. Max never made special demands. He was never difficult. He stayed in the same small huts as everyone else.
I read that a student filmmaker asked him to do a film, yeah. and he asked for a sandwich as his payment. No, but for real.
Yeah. He did the film.
He did that.
Yeah. Max von Sydow is a special person on Earth.
Yes.
Like McCoy Tyner.
An artist.
Mark Crowley. Can I talk about a couple things here and then...
Yes.
When you're sitting at home in the next 4, 8...
2 months.
12 weeks.
Or singing on your balcony if you're in Italy or Spain.
Jennifer and I were singing tonight. Our neighbors were unappreciative of our...
We sing a lot of parody songs, and I don't think our neighbors are appreciative of that.
I'm not even
going to
delve
into that. Yeah, we do that, but no.
Feeding America is on Twitter. It's at Feeding America. They have a website that you can go to. And when you go to that website, you can type in your zip code and city and whatnot and state. And we gave today to the one in Los Angeles because we live in Los Angeles. California, as we've discovered, a great deal of the United States lives in California. A great deal of California lives in Los Angeles. So it's called Los Angeles Regional Food Bank, and it's at lafoodbank.org.
Also, if you live in the States and you want to give to schools and kids, donorschoose.org.
Donorchoose.org is awesome.
It's school projects. You can put in your zip code. You can put in literacy programs,
yeah.
Whatever specific subject matter that you want to focus on. And it's teachers asking for help for their projects.
And it's everything. It's crayons, paper, whatnot.
Yeah, it's even backpacks and snacks sometimes.
It's astonishing how underfunded schools are in the United States, and it's really disappointing.
It's grotesque. It's really upsetting.
Beyond all measure. NoKidHungry.org. NoKidHungry.org is another giant organization that works to get food to underprivileged children. During the crisis, we're going to have to really think about the people who live on the street and the people who are young.
Well, and elderly people. You have to look in on your neighbors. We have neighbors who have health issues, and you have to contact them and let them know that you're available to do errands for them.
That's a very good idea and extremely charitable. I was going to buy a mask and drive around Monterey Bay Aquarium.
In your Jeep?
So much in my Jeep. Jennifer, if there's two things you know about me. One, that I only do two things, half dank and smash beers and drive around in my Jeep to the detriment of mankind. MontereyBayAquarium.org. They have a live camera. And look at this, Jennifer. You can watch live feedings when they're closed.
Penguins and otters.
Yeah. Aviary cam, coral reef cam, jelly cam, kelp forest cam, Monterey Bay.
Penguin cam.
Yeah. It's called MontereyBayAquarium.org. And
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. If you want to spend some time.
National Gallery in D.C. also has, on their site, you can watch a gallery a day.
They've started that
this week. And then didn't you tell me the Met?
The Met's going to have an opera. Is it every night? The Metropolitan Opera in New York.
Starting Tuesday?
Tuesday. I'm going to look that up while we're talking here.
Because that's beautiful. Because as we've seen in Italy and Spain, music helps everyone get through this.
There's nothing but art.
Although I was a little alarmed at the number of people in Spain that had tambourines.
That's shocking, right?
I don't know if I want my neighbor to have a tambourine.
I've been singing out the window for so long.
We always sing. Oh. Maybe, you know.
Could stop during the pandemic. The website is metopera.org, metopera.org, and then it's Season Radio Free Live Audio Streams. It'll lift your spirits, and it'll take you to a higher plane of Colchester. We won't be doing any live gigs. Who's Live Anyway was taken off the road peremptorily, and for the public good.
Scheduled.
Public good. We'll be back in the autumn and the summer, and it's imperative now that we don't gather in groups and that we give each other a little bit of space so that we can flatten the curve on this pandemic and really make it resolve at a certain point. Don't believe the whole thing about being in public all the time that I think spreads the...
What are you saying?
What?
No, you have to avoid groups. Don't go out when you don't have to. Be really cautious. Take care of yourself. Because we're not certain... We need to make this make as few people exposed as possible. Even young people who have pre-existing conditions are at risk. You have to be really cautious and be respectful of the situation. And you know, this is the time to hunker down.
There's no question of that. It's a situation that requires us to be alone for a while, and that's going to be really weird for everyone.
Does that mean that you're going to watch the same movies over and over, and I have to go in the other room?
It's interesting that you asked that, Jennifer, because
we watched all the President's Men last night.
We had a Robert Redford festival last night, which I thought was pretty hot, in my opinion.
By the way, is it a little scary that Nixon wanted a Medicare for All plan in the 70s?
I thought Nixon had two good ideas.
EPA.
Yeah.
Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
And he wanted a medical plan for everyone.
That Hillary Clinton later.
Yes. Vote Biden. Biden.
You've been the smartest crowd in the world. We've been the smartest couple in the world. May every bell that rings for you be a cool papa bell. May every
ooh, page tell that... Jader. Love it. Right?
This shit got real. And I don't even know why. And may everything that happens to you be something that happens to you for a good reason. Be safe, my darlings. Sanitize and stay home.
Wash those paws.